We open Fresh Air today with a 1926 recording of the original Jelly Roll Blues featuring Jelly Roll Morton's Red Hot Peppers. This afternoon on Fresh Air at 4 o'clock, we'll discuss Northern Ireland. In America, we can read almost daily of continuing skirmishes and violence in Northern Ireland, but it's very easy to remain confused about what the real underlying issues are that keep the country divided. I'll have three guests with me, each of whom has written about Northern Ireland. Michael Pakenham, an associate editor of the Philadelphia Inquirer, wrote the Agonies of Ireland series last December that was featured on the op-ed page with accompanying editorials. Historian Dennis Clark is the author of Irish Blood, Northern Ireland, and the American Conscience. Reverend Michael Doyle was sent to Northern Ireland last year by Today magazine, for whom he wrote the story An Irish Journal. When they join us at 4 o'clock, we'll open up the phones for your questions. Every Thursday at 3:30, Francis Davis hosts Interval, a review of new jazz releases. Today, two previously unreleased sessions by Charles Mingus and Charlie Parker. Last year, journalist Lawrence Weskler made two trips to Poland and published his reports in the New Yorker magazine. These reports are now published in a new book called Solidarity, Poland in the Season of Its Passion. Weskler will be with us in about a half hour or 40 minutes. A few months ago, public television stations were asked if they would like to participate in an experiment allowing them to run a limited number of commercials during the broadcast day. The experiment is the creation of the Temporary Commission on Alternative Financing for Public Telecommunications. This commission was created by Congress last year, who gave it the task of identifying new funding options for public broadcasting. This experiment is very controversial amongst public broadcasting professionals and public broadcasting viewers. Of the stations who applied, 10 were chosen. One of the 10 is WHYY Channel 12, WUHY's television affiliate. Since we know many of our listeners are Channel 12 viewers, we asked Jim Carrion to discuss with us Channel 12's participation in the experiment and what it will mean for viewers of Channel 12. Jim Carrion is the president and general manager of WHYY Incorporated, which includes WHYY Channel 12 and WUHY Radio. To clarify, the commercial experiment is for television stations only. We know you probably have a lot of questions about this experiment, so we'll be opening up the phones in just a few minutes for your questions. Before we open the phones, could you welcome to Fresh Air, Jim Carrion.
Thank you.
And could you tell us what this experiment is going to mean and why Channel 12 decided to participate in it?
Yes. In the Broadcasting Act of 1981, the Congress proposed, as you said, this temporary commission to see if there were other ways to finance public broadcasting, both radio and television. And one part of it was to do an experiment to see over 18 months whether or not 10 radio and 10 television stations could experiment in it, see that what it would do, see if it would bring in real revenue, see if it would not break the bond that radio and television stations have, public radio and television stations have with their publics and all of that, and continue to keep the character and integrity of public radio and public television. There was a process of applications to the commission and so on and so forth. And as you said, it was quite controversial as to whether it would work or not. And a group of television stations, at least, and some joint licensees, us being one of them, did ask the commission finally to allow us to at least do the experiment. There had been a idea and some feeling on the parts of some of our national leaders that we should do the experiment on paper. My feeling on that when I testified was you can't do experiments on paper. Experiments can only be done if they are done. I think it was very important to do it. One, I think it was important because Congress gave us this opportunity. I think if we did not take it and try as hard as we could to see if it would work or not, they would not again give us a chance or an opportunity to conduct such an experiment. The other thing is that obviously all of us are at a place right now where we have to find alternative sources of funding. It doesn't mean that it's a substitute for the contributions we get from the public. I think we all cherish and we all understand our role as public broadcasters, but we know that with federal grants becoming less, we know with the costs becoming higher, we have to have other kind of funding than just the public contribution, which at times is quixotic, at times it's unpredictable, and that even though our audience continue growing and our support keeps growing. The second part of that commission, Terry, and I think the people should know, is that by June of this year, the commission is supposed to come up with a document for Congress on other ways that we might finance ourselves. And that is very interesting because it's the first time ever since the first Public Broadcasting Act was signed in 67 that Congress has ever asked us how we would like to be funded. Because it's been one of those questions that was never asked or it was never really addressed. In the original Carnegie Commission report, the Carnegie One, which was sort of the Bible to all of this, when the federal government got into public broadcasting and so on, the recommendation of the Carnegie Commission was that there be a tax on the sale of sets in America and that that would be distributed to public broadcasting. There were no public radio stations at that time or no network of public radio station. The Johnson administration just didn't want to contend with that. They thought that if they got the federal funding going in the beginning, it would be better, and that a year later, public broadcasting would come back with an idea of how to fund itself. It never has, really. So we have an opportunity through the commission to look at ideas like taxing on the use of sets, a tax as they do in Great Britain, tax on the use of sets, which is in Great Britain, or as Carnegie One said, a tax on the sale of sets. I think if there was a tax on the sale of sets in this country alone, just on the sale of them one time, I think a dollar for every $100 a set cost on television sets, it would bring in something like $600 million a year. It's phenomenal. I didn't know that many new sets were being bought each year, but they are. The commission is looking at things like a national lottery. They're looking at things like the possible tax on the accumulated gross profits of commercial radio or commercial television, also a possible taxation on the advertising revenue of radio and television, of commercial radio and television. There is also an idea for checkoff on income tax and all of that. None of this will all go back to Congress. It doesn't mean, and people shouldn't think out there, my God, they've got all these opportunities to collect all this money. It doesn't mean that Congress would ever agree to it or anything like that. With the advertising experiment, it's 18 months in duration. They did pick 10 television stations, as you said, and we are one of them. It was agreed there would no, at this time at least, there would be no public radio stations selected, though there were four of the television stations who are joint licensees. That to the public means that they are corporations that own or control both radio and public radio and television stations. We filed as a joint licensee, for instance. But at the time, for the time being at least, the commission did not deal with radio. So it does deal just with television. And what we are supposed to do is in this next – well, actually, almost 6 months has gone by so far. They're trying to get an extension of this so the experiment at least has a decent time to be tried – is to see if with some limit – very limited advertising, we can find if it's feasible and, as I say, a whole set of things we have to look at.
Well, before we open up the phones, can you describe what the structure is and what the regulations are surrounding the experiment? How many commercials will there be on Channel 12? How will it affect what we see when we turn on Channel 12?
Well, we have, as the other 10, have not totally laid out. Every station has a right or had a right to submit their proposal and do different things. For instance, Channel 13 in New York and the Pittsburgh station are talking about underwriting enrichment. I don't know quite what that is. It sounds like being slightly pregnant, but that's what they're talking about. Binghamton, New York has an interesting idea. They're not going to do commercials. They're going to do public service announcements like for art museums and colleges and that, and in turn they will get products from them, and they'll use those products as premiums to get new members for the stations. It's a very convoluted thing, but it's something like that. So each station is putting in their own. Congress only said put down certain mandates. One, that we could run no commercials no more than 2 minutes every half hour if we chose to. That we could not run commercials in the middle of any program. So you won't have that unless the program is over 2 hours in length. That there would be no sponsorship. It can't be like General Motors brings you, and there'll be commercials in that like you see on commercial television or anything like that. It did not say they have to be in clusters, but no doubt there will be. All the questions of the frequency, in other words, how often they'll be on, how many, what days, if every day, what kind will be taken, in other words, will they all be institutional commercials or will they actually be product commercials, the length of the commercials, whether they be one-minute commercials or 30-second, all of that has to be determined by the 10 of us together and also by each individual participant themselves.
So that's still yet to be determined?
That's still to be determined, yeah.
Let's open up the phones. I'm sure our listeners have a lot of questions about this experiment and how it will work. Our number, if you have any questions, is 923-2774, and our phones are now open. We're at area code 215, and the number is 923-2774. With me is Jim Carrion, who's the president and general manager of WHYY, and we're discussing the participation of Channel 12 in this experiment to try commercials on public television. There are 9 other stations participating in this experiment. If you have any questions about what it's going to mean, you can call us at 923-2774. How are you going to evaluate its success for Channel 12?
Well, we have a whole system, as we did in making our proposal to the commission, and that was a whole series of research that would go on. In proposing, each station had to show that they had done a survey both of the advertising market in their community, of institutions in their community, of underwriters, which we have now, and of the general public. I mean, I can't stress enough that nobody – this is an experiment. And, you know, I think we're very lucky to have it in Philadelphia because it's an interesting market, far different than Chicago or New York, which are very strange and isolated. But this is – as it is in so many ways, it's the fourth largest broadcast market in America, and yet it is very much a hometown type of thing, and so it's an interesting place to do the experiment. But I think that we're all aware, we're all dedicated broadcasters, and all of those who wanted to come into this, we know the sensitive relationship between that we've built over a quarter of a century with our publics. We respect and cherish, as I said, our role as alternative public broadcasters, and we know what that is. We know it's an experiment. We know that any misjudgments or misactions, if I can use the word, on our part will hurt not only ourselves but all the rest of the system, and we don't intend to do that.
923-2774 is our phone number if you have any questions. Do you think that this might obscure the difference between commercial and public media?
No. Not unless we get greedy, frankly, and don't use restraint and don't use good judgment. And I think if that happened, I would be opposed to it myself. When I remember 10 years ago when we started, in order to get national programming dollars, we started doing underwriters, as you have even with Masterpiece Theater, that this had brought to you by a grant from Mobil Oil Company. And a lot of people in our system felt that that would destroy us. It was a form of commercialization in that it hasn't done a thing to us.
What do you think the financial future of public television is?
Well, it looks bleak at the present time. I mean, a lot of people and peers of ours have said that. Certainly there is if the legislation goes through, there's going to be gigantic cuts in the federal money. I happen to be a supreme optimist. I'm usually a cynic, but I think we cynics are disappointed optimists. But I believe for the first time in a quarter of a century, the public is getting the message that they're really going to have to pay for it. And they really have to pay so little for it, either in radio or television. And as you know, Channel 12 is going through a fundraiser right now, and we're getting monies like we have never gotten before. And I know that just a few months ago when we did one at UHYFM, we got very high funds.
Okay, well, let's take our first phone call. There are a number of open lines. If you have a question that you'd like to ask Jim Carrion, the president and general manager of WHYY, any questions about this participation in the commercial experiment, you can call us at area code 215. The number is 923-2774. Hello, this is Fresh Air, and you're on the air.
Hello. I have a comment, more or less. If I heard correctly, a program that would last 2 hours in length could be interrupted by these commercials, and I think that would make me very unhappy.
The Congress only said that it could be done. It doesn't mean that any of us would do it. I have, for instance, a great doubt that we would do it at Channel 12, for instance, if an opera is on or something like that, that we would break in to do a commercial. I do think that's getting very close into what a commercial station is. I think if we can, we would only do them at the start and at the conclusion of full broadcast. All they said is you can do no more than 2 minutes every 30 minutes, and you cannot cut into a program unless that program runs over 2 hours. We don't have that many programs that run over 2 hours except for some operas.
Mm-hmm. I'm also rather concerned that people will feel that their responsibility is gone to support public television.
No, I hope if we do a good job of informing our publics, our audiences, our own system, and that won't happen. It's just the reality of what the costs are. For instance, if the cuts take place that the current administration is asking for in the federal money, for instance, in this station alone, we could lose as much as $330,000 next year in our community service grants, which is the way the money is given to individual stations in the country. And with that has to be made up. A lot of that will be made up by the public, not all of it.
Well, what I'm concerned about is that people seeing that business is supporting, television, public television, that they will feel they no longer have a responsibility to join or have these memberships. I think that's going to take harder work to convince the public that they do have a responsibility if they want that kind of television.
Well, I think they do. And as I say, why I'm optimistic at this moment is that we have, for instance, Channel 12 just reached in January a cum, which we call in our business a 50. We broke 50. There's been only about 8 or 10 public television stations in the history to ever do that. That means we're reaching one out of every two households in the Delaware Valley. But we still only have about one out of every 10 viewer who watches us regularly paying dues. And the dues are very little, or their memberships. We can bring that up. We're doing that. But whether that all is done, I think all public television stations have to find other kinds of funding.
Thanks so much for your phone call.
Thank you.
Bye-bye. If you have any questions about Channel 12's participation in this experiment in trying commercials on public TV, you can give us a call at 923-2774 at area code 215. It's 923-2774. Hi, this is Fresh Air, and you're on the air.
Hello.
Go ahead.
Yeah, my name's Martin Solish, and I'm calling you long distance from Pomona, New Jersey.
Mm-hmm.
I think you should do the commercials at the beginning and end of every program. Because I think that some of the attitudes that I think I've heard implied on public TV and public radio indicate that PBS, at least WHUY and WHYY, are more oriented toward commercial thinking than public thinking. Like, for example, I have to dial a long-distance number to get in touch with you now, you see. But when you want money, you provide an 800 number, a toll-free number. So my question is, are you interested really in the public response?
No, I think there's
not make it easier for the public to respond to you.
Well,
another question is, I have two more questions, okay? One is, how are the people who solicit the contributions as is happening right now on Value Nights on WHYY, how are these people compensated? And what kinds of salaries and what kinds of perks are enjoyed by our corporate executives over at UHY and WHYY? Those are kinds of questions that I would like to have answered before I make another contribution to public radio.
I should mention to our callers that we are trying to keep this phone in strictly on the subject of the commercial experiment.
Yeah, well, I think, frankly, it ought to go commercial because I think your attitudes are more oriented that way than toward the public. I think, as a matter of fact, you're not really serving the public interest, but rather your own.
Well, I couldn't obviously disagree with you more, but I think if you look at our programming now and look at the audiences we're reaching both on radio and television, that just isn't true. For instance, if we wanted to get more commercial, quote unquote, we would change all of our programming. We do programming which we feel is not being gotten in any other kind of medium, and I think we do that. It's indicated by, again, the enormous increases in ratings, and not only by the number of people, but the kind of people. We're reaching all elements of the public now. At one time, we used to be called elitists. We can't be called that anymore.
Well, thank you for your phone call. We do want to get to as many calls as possible.
See, this is what I mean, Terry.
What?
Now cutting me off because you don't like what I'm saying.
Listen, I don't think that's fair, to tell you the truth.
Well, I know you don't think it's fair. Just as a long time ago when you had a question program,
uh-huh.
I called up and said, I like Steve Brooks very much. I really like the guy. I like his program. I used to listen to him every morning. But I asked you a question, like, why doesn't he play more of a variety of classical music, you know? And you asked me what I meant, and I said, well, maybe toss in something a little perky now and then. And you said, well, you know, if that's what you need to wake you up in the morning, see, that's what I need.
Well, I don't think I can speak for Terry Gross, and I'm sure she wasn't being flip with you. We change programs to reach and serve as many of our publics as possible. And you certainly get as fine classical music, I think, on UHY as you're going to get any place in this city. And we could change that easily and get a much higher audience with other kind of programming, but we don't.
Thanks so much for your phone call. Hi, this is Fresh Air. You're on the air. And if anyone else has any questions, our number is 923-2774. And we're asking you to keep your questions to the subject of the commercial experiment on public television. Hi, you're on the air.
Hi, Terry. It's Adele. I have a question for Jim. I would like to ask him if the quality of the programming will be dictated by the companies who are paying for the commercials.
Well, it certainly will not unless we lose our own restraint and, as I say, our sound judgment, no more than in taking national underwriting as we have for programming. We've allowed that to dictate it. I don't think it will, no. I would be opposed to it. Anybody, I think, working in this system would be. We know what we're in this for. To answer you or the gentleman before, the perks we get and the salaries we get are not the least bit commensurate with our colleagues in commercial broadcasting.
Oh, I'm sure of that.
I don't think it will. No, it will not.
I would hope not.
It will not.
I mean, if there are 10 stations who have to decide upon this, suppose, you know, that there's some discrepancy between each of you as to how...
No, each station will make its own rules and its own guidelines and that on how they're going to conduct their experiment and what they're going to take and so on.
Oh, that's good.
Mm-hmm.
Okay, Jim, thank you.
You're welcome.
Thanks for your call. Bye-bye. Hi, this is Fresh Air. You're on the air.
Hi, I'm interested in finding out what your demographics are. That, like, everybody has the Nielsen's and some of these other, I guess, Arbitron ratings and things like that. Does UHY really know who they are reaching?
WHY, why I'm speaking now for the television, which is what I guess your question is
right.
Related to, is part of both Arbitron and Nielsen ratings. At one time in this country, Nielsen or Arbitron did not rate any show that was not sponsored. That included on a commercial network even. They have for a number of years now been putting all programming. So we know from them what audience we reach, where we reach it. We know something about their age groups, their economic groups, their background, and we do an awful lot of research ourselves.
Okay. Another thing that I would like to find out is...
Is this about the commercial experiment?
Yes.
Okay.
About who decides what kind of commercial actually goes on? I've seen the logos and a short, like, maybe two-sentence phrase that states, like, somebody is into, like, chemicals and fuels and things like that. Who is actually going to decide what the commercials, what form they're going to take?
Well, that's going to be done by the management here, and staff people will have experts in that. And, again, as I say, we're coming down on the side of restraint and sound judgments. One of the things I'm very strong about, and everybody is, that any commercial endorsement will bring forth any questions of falsehood or distortion or confusion to our publics. One of the questions we get from a lot of people, are we going to do products or are we only going to take institutional commercials? That has not been decided yet. If we do take products, are we going to take one product over another product? That has not been decided yet. I think, as I say, we will always come down on the side of good taste and good judgment. One of the attractions we have to any advertiser is the audience we have. If we lose faith with that audience or lose that audience and the special quality of our audience, we're not going to be able to have an advertising rate in pure good business sense. We're going to kill ourselves before it's even over.
Okay, thank you very much.
Thanks for your call. Bye-bye. 923-2774 or 2775 is our number. I think we might be having some trouble with the 2774 line, so why don't you try us at 923-2775. My guest is Jim Carrion, the president and general manager of WHYY, and we're talking about Channel 12's participation in the experiment to try commercials on public television. And you can call us if you have any questions. Hi, this is Fresh Air, and you're on the air.
Hi, I just wanted to say that I tend to agree with the man who called from New Jersey a few minutes ago. It seems to me Channel 12 has become increasingly committed to commercial or fundraising concerns, and I am really concerned. I don't object to 2 minutes a half hour, and I assume that commercials would be tasteful, more tasteful than commercial television. I don't object to that, except that I really am concerned that programs of 2 hours or less will be interrupted in the future because I base that on the fact that the fundraising appeals never interrupted programs until about a year and a half ago, something like that. Now they do interrupt programs. They go on at length in the middle of programs. And I tried to watch Julia the other night, and it was interrupted repeatedly at length. So that, and I think all of us who watch Channel 12 know you need money. And quite frankly, I had given much more than the minimum for a number of years, and I quit when you started interrupting programs because I really object to that.
Well, ma'am, we have to really do that, and our chief source of reaching the public is not renewals through the mail or anything. It is on-the-air pledging, and it is not more than it was, and we have not changed any policy, nor no station I know in the country has in the last few years. We always, during those three fundraising periods each year, and there are only three, I want to remind you of something. Public television stations have some flexibility in this, but I think last survey showed that the one that does more fundraising than anyone spent, I think, 290 hours a year, something like that, in fundraising. And the lowest commercial station, whether it be a network affiliate or just an independent station, was doing something like 1,280 hours a year. I mean, there is no comparison. It may seem like during those times that we do a lot of fundraising. It has not increased. And we try to, and every night we do a fundraiser, we always ask people if they would like to raise all the money right there at the top of the evening. We will cut off all the fundraising. We even tried in our December fundraiser an experiment during the movie Gigi that we raised. We said if people wanted to give all the money, we would run it without any breaks. We would run it uninterrupted. There were supposed to be four breaks. People gave enough money in two calls, one before and one during, that we only broke in once. So it really is up to you.
Right. Well, it doesn't help the people who have already given. And I really do disagree with you that you aren't doing more, maybe not more minutes per se, but you did not interrupt shows until I would say a year and a half, 2 years ago. I don't know. I can't give you the date. But I have watched too much of Channel 12 to not have realized that. I mean, it really hit me like a brick bat the first time I saw it. My gosh, now, you know, this is bad enough because your fundraising is really, I don't care for it, which you can't help. It just seems kind of shrill, and I think all of us are bright enough that we have the message. And and I know you have to keep reminding us.
Yeah.
Yes, that's fine. I understand that. But really, when you start interrupting programs, that is when you lost me as one of your contributors. And I really miss getting that monthly magazine, not as much for Channel 12 as for the radio, because you can't pick up things that are on radio from the newspapers.
Let's give Jim Carrey the chance to respond to your call.
Yeah,
let
me say one thing about that. If people would, I told earlier that 1.2 million households, this isn't individuals, this is households, and we are most happy to accept more than one membership from any household. But there's 1.2 million households in the Delaware Valley are listening to us regularly. If one quarter of those households would pay their $25 a year dues, just one quarter, we would have $7.5 million right now. Now, if they did that, we would be ecstatic. If one half of those people who watch us regularly paid $25 a year, it would be $15 million and so on. So we have to do a lot to get, you say people understand the need for the money, but they have to be reminded they're going to have to pay for the system. That's all there is to it.
Thanks for your call. We'll take another call. Hi, this is Fresh Air. You're on the air.
Yes, thank you. I hope that I'm on the subject, as you've been stressing, because I came in a little bit in the middle of this. But I would like to at least say that I agree with the last woman who was on the phone that it is offensive. And I'm just to make sure I'm on the subject. Let's see. I'm correct in recalling that Carl Sagan was on the television station we're referring to, right?
Yes, he was on PBS and the series Cosmos,
right.
Yes.
All right, that's the subject we're talking about, right?
What we're talking about is the experiment to try commercial public television.
Okay.
So if your question is germane to that subject.
Right, and that's Channel 12 on the TV, right?
That's right.
Okay, I sort of feel that when I was watching that and they were taking funds or donations, whatever you call it, it just seemed to me that the money was trickling in, and then someone came up with, you know, thousands of dollars in a single donation for Carl Sagan. Now, I think that Carl Sagan might be an expensive show to put on, and I think that Carl Sagan might be bordering on commercial as the type of show it is. You know what I mean? I mean, I think that it should be on commercial TV. I think Carl Sagan should be on commercial TV, and I think that maybe what I used to see years ago on Channel 12 were things that were less expensive and easier to fund. And I think that maybe that's really part of what my image of public TV should be.
Well,
and I think that if you have to put on more expensive shows, I think you should go commercial, because somehow the commercials on TV really are offering people a service. And I think it sort of shares the expense a little bit better.
Yeah, the series Cosmos cost over $8 million to produce, and there are three commercial networks in this country. There are many groups, syndicates of stations. Nobody ever produced a series on that subject. It was one of the highest-rated series ever on public broadcasting and vitally needed, I think. And I don't. It was a very expensive series, but it certainly, I think, it showed that it was needed by the country. People responded to it. They wanted it, and they were not getting it any other place.
Thanks for your call. If you're just joining us, my guest is Jim Carrion, who's the president and general manager of WHYY, and we're talking about Channel 12's participation in this experiment to try a limited number of commercials within public television as an alternate source of fundraising. And if your question is on that subject, hi, this is Fresh Air. You're on the air.
Hello. I guess you're aware, I'm sure you are, there was an article in Focus magazine which came out today concerning commercials on Channel 12. And there are two quotes in it that I think are matters of particular concern to me. One is the manager of corporate contributions at Sun Company, who says, if Channel 12 becomes more commercial, then so will we. If Channel 12 is getting more for my dollars, then I want more for my dollars. And he says that he wants more recognition of his product as a result of that sponsorship. So I think there's a change of emphasis in the kind of commercials that would be offered. The other quote comes from an advertising agency principal who says, whether you like it or not, public TV with commercials is not public TV. I'd like to hear your comments on that.
Yes, well, I know the article. Obviously, I don't miss articles that have my picture on the cover. But the Sun Company, gentlemen, is new to their donations to public broadcasting, and I agree that they want more recognition, but more recognition is being given to underwriters and has not offended our viewers in any way. If you'll notice, the Federal Communication Commission last year allowed us now to, at the end of it, actually let underwriters use a logo. If you see on Masterpiece Theater, for instance, there is a mobile logo now where there hasn't been, and it even allows you to identify what the product is. The gentleman who said that, who we know served on our advisory council here on our business and industry committee and so on, who said that public broadcasting with commercials is no longer public broadcasting, I don't think that's necessarily true. I think, again, it is the amount, it is the kind, it is how much we do in advance of making our public understand. Even the people who've called in to talk about the fundraising and say that, we always go on every night. I've seen to it since I've been president here to announce exactly how much we want to raise that night, how much we think the public wants us to raise. Because obviously, if we're getting so many more viewers all the time, we must be doing something right. And therefore, we have to tell them how much it costs to run the place. And every night we go on, I say we take, in the next 5 minutes, if we can reach the goal we need tonight, $39,600, $40,300, we will not do one bit of fundraising tonight. It is really the public who can dictate what we do.
Well, I suppose that's true from one standpoint. But I, as an individual, can't do anything to put it over. And I find myself very distressed when I watch the fundraising. Because to me, you're making a medium which I really enjoy totally unenjoyable for the entire period of the fundraising.
Well, but also, you know, what we give you, and one of the, I mean, it is sort of a give and take thing, because also some of the finest programming, some of the best specials that are ever run in the whole year are the ones that are purchased, especially during those fundraising times. If you look at this current 16 days in March, as Channel 12 and also what the network has done, has purchased a lot of programming that we would never have on otherwise. So even though you have to go and listen to some of the pitches, you also are getting some programming you never get otherwise.
I suppose that's true. One thing that...
Sir, can you keep it brief because we're running out of time?
Just one thought. The Philadelphia Orchestra recently ran a fundraising campaign over another Philadelphia radio station and raised quite a sum of money without, in my opinion, becoming quite as annoying as the pitches in the present fundraising. I just wish that something could be learned from that.
Well, they patterned their auction, their marathon, after our auctions, which we have been doing for 10 years, and they have been doing their marathons for 4. I agree with you. They do a very nice job.
Thanks so much for your call. Bye-bye. That's all the calls we'll have time for. If you still have a comment but you didn't get a chance to call in, you can write as well. And the address to write to would be WHYY, 150 North 6th Street, Philadelphia, 19106. Jim Carrion, when will these commercials that have been discussed this afternoon be starting?
On Channel 12, I doubt if we will begin until midsummer, when everything is in line, when we have all of our rates, when we have all the frequency and all of that done, and know that we're going to do as much as we can to not make them offensive, not to offend our audiences, not to offend the people who've been very good to us. We will do them, and not before. But I think it'll be mid-September, some summer.
Okay, I want to thank you for explaining how it's going to work, and I want to thank our listeners who called with their questions and comments. I've been speaking with Jim Carrion, who's the president and general manager of WHYY, and we've been talking about Channel 12's participation in this experiment to try a limited number of commercials on public television as an alternate way, or an additional way, I should say, to raise funds. And this is happening at the time when federal funding for public media is being cut back. Thanks to everybody who called, and thanks again to you, Jim Carrion, for talking with us. 17 minutes to 3 is the time. This is Fresh Air. You're tuned to WUHY-FM in Philadelphia. In about 5 minutes on Fresh Air, my guest will be Lawrence Weskler. He's the author of a new book called Solidarity, Poland in the Season of Its Passion. He'll be with us in about 5 minutes on Fresh Air. This is Duke Ellington, and it's his tribute to that is portrait of Sidney Bechet from his New Orleans suite. Duke Ellington with Paul Gonzalez, featured on Soprano, and that was a portrait of Sidney Bechet, featured as part of the New Orleans suite. It's 12 minutes to 3. This is Fresh Air on WUHY-FM in Philadelphia. Just some news for you. U.S. Senator Harrison Williams of New Jersey, convicted and sentenced in the Abscam bribery sting, has told the entire Senate that he is resigning. His resignation comes just hours before the Senate was expected to vote to expel him. A move to have him censured rather than ousted from the Senate appeared doomed to failure due to lack of support. So there'll be more news about that on this evening's edition of All Things Considered and on 91 Report following All Things Considered at 6:29. Well, with me now on Fresh Air is Lawrence Weskler, the author of a new book called Solidarity, Poland in the Season of Its Passion. It's just been published by Fireside Books. The book is based on his two trips to Poland last year, one trip in May and another that spanned September and October. His reports on Poland were first published in the New Yorker magazine, where he's a staff writer. Welcome to Fresh Air.
Thank you.
Is Poland of special personal interest to you?
Actually not. I mean, it has become so. I originally, last year in January, I was doing a piece for Playboy on the situation of the left in the United States, which was going to be called What's Left, and I had to go around the country and get a sense of what was going on in the left in the wake of the Reagan election at that point. And it was a very disheartening kind of trip because the answer was nothing. And there was such a lack of politics and so forth. Eventually, that particular article got spiked and never ran in Playboy. The general attitude was that there was so little going on that you couldn't even sustain interest in talking about how little was going on. But I was then on assignment for The New Yorker in Denmark in May. I was doing an article about a museum in Denmark and just on my own, almost kind of like just to get a sense of what it's like to have politics going on, I went to Poland. I really, as of May when I went, I really didn't have any particular knowledge. And one of the things two things happen in a political situation like that. First of all, ordinary people start doing great things, become incredibly political. And secondly, if you come there with your eyes at all open, the world is incredibly well ventilated and you just very quickly, if you just listen to what's going on, you get into some very deep sets of issues. And people were tremendously open. It was possible, for example, to go up to Gdansk and, you know, just within 2 hours be talking to the number two person in Solidarity, you know, just because they were very eager to talk to people. And it wasn't the kind of canned stuff you get in political reporting here. They really wanted to know what your thoughts on what they should be doing or when they wanted to tell you what they were doing and so forth. And so it was a tremendously exciting experience, and I came out of there and I had gone in without any intention of writing at all. When I came out, I sat down and I wrote a manuscript which at that time was called 93 Visions of Poland, and it was 93 stories. I mean, it became 93 when I finished counting them up, and it was just 1, 2, 3, 4. And I wasn't really trying to lay an analysis on top, but very concretely give a kind of anecdotal sense, because it seemed to me that was the problem with coverage up to that point. I really didn't have a sense of what it was like on the ground in Poland. I had a sense of – and particularly at that time, especially back in May, the main reportage in the United States was almost exclusively whether the Soviets were going to invade. That's May 1981 now. And that, as one Solidarity official in Gdansk told me, he said, I mean, your American reporters are driving us crazy. I mean, in this factory right over here, and he pointed over to the shipyard, he says, one of the most amazing experiments in democratic socialism ever undertaken by anyone is taking place, and all your reporters can do is hang out there at the peninsula looking out to see whether the Russians are coming. And
well, I think one of the people you spoke to suggested that maybe the reporters felt that that type of union organizing was as threatening to corporate capitalism as
In fairness to the people who were doing the reporting in Poland, it was all often the editors in the United States and corporate editors who, I mean, you might remember back there was there was this whole period where it almost felt like Haig was saying every morning, you know, they're going to invade tomorrow morning. They're, you know, the Soviets are building up, and it almost began to seem like he was wishing that they would invade. And I really do think that what Solidarity did represent at its high point, if Solidarity had been able to work, it would have thrown into question all kinds of things about Western capitalism. And one example of that is just for starters, the most immediate one. The strike, when it took place in August 1980 in Gdansk, There was negotiations taking place across the table, and there was Lech Walesa and a few other people. And Lech Walesa, who had been an unemployed electrician 2 weeks earlier, and there he was negotiating with the deputy prime minister and so forth. But the negotiations were being piped live as they were happening over the PA system of the entire factory. The factory had been occupied by the workers. This is, by the way, another kind of thing that just, I would think, terrifies Ford Motor Company and so forth, the idea that when you go on strike, the workers don't leave the factory, they stay in the factory. And something the Poles had learned to do over a period of years and over a period of failed strikes, and they had really learned how to do it right.
This to what prevent scabs from coming in and work?
Well, in our context, it does that. It also, in the context of Polish history, they had learned that when they left the factory, they got massacred in 1970 and so forth, and they weren't going to, you know, the factory was their stronghold. But at any rate, so you had 16,000 workers occupying the Lenin shipyards, and over the PA system, you had these very intense negotiations. And I'm just by comparison, these recent Ford negotiations about downsizing the contract and so forth. Can you imagine? I mean, there were days where you didn't know what was happening. And they were very proud that they had a news blackout on it and so forth. And then when it was all over, that came out. Well, when you see what happens, how workers are, the actual negotiation process. There was a film that was made after that, during the thing, and was released and was shown in Poland, and called Workers 80, which, by the way, is a copy has been smuggled out of the country and is going to begin to show in the United States. And I just very much recommend to any of your listeners to see that. It's one of the most incredible documentaries I've ever seen. An hour and a half of, you know, the actual negotiations, but you also see the workers outside listening in. And at a certain point, the government negotiator says, well, you know, at one point there's this way. So this is very nice, this negotiation we're having, but don't you think it would be more effective if we went to Warsaw where we could, you know, be more closer to the party headquarters? And outside the workers are yelling, no, are you kidding, and so forth. And Lech Walesa is rolling his rosary beads and he says, I don't think they want us to leave, you know. And it's interesting to think of if labor was in the United States that way. But that's just one example of the kinds of things that I think really did scare corporate capitals. And by the way, it's a fact that Wall Street Journal, the day of the coup, reported, a couple days after the coup in December of last year, reported that bankers were happy. American bankers, Western German bankers were happy that the coup had taken place, that solidarity had gotten completely out of hand, both in terms of becoming somewhat anarchistic, but also in terms of, you know, it's just going to be a pain having this thing around.
So. When you first started interviewing people, the climate was pretty open. People weren't afraid of speaking openly about what they were doing. They said to you, use my name and make sure you spell it correctly.
Right.
And you chose not to use their names. Are you glad now that you didn't?
Well, I mean, the rule I followed was that if it was someone who was known as a core leader and so forth or solidarity leader, I would use their name. But you know, this was the decision I made was back in November when we were running it in the New Yorker. And at that point, I was really haunted because they'd said, use our names. We want our children to know that we were doing this and spell it right, you know. And I guess already in November, well, the way the book is presented and the way the articles are presented, there's a section on May and what life was like then and a section on September. And I think the section on September is already very dark and so forth. I don't think I was any special person to have had a premonition that things were coming to unravel at that point. And I did not use their names, and I know that many of them wish I still had, even ones who are in prison and so forth, that they would have wanted their kids to know. But I don't have as much nerve as they do.
Have you been able to keep in touch with people who you met there?
I've kept in touch with some through roundabout ways. I get absolutely wrenching letters occasionally. For the people who do know the pieces in the New Yorker, I'd say about half the people that I interviewed are currently in jail or in detention camps at least. Many of the people I get these absolutely elaborate letters on, you know, strategies for getting out, you know, and I mean, one I got a few days ago from a film director who was saying how he was going, I should do this and this and this that would help him to on his side do something. But beyond that, he would then divorce his wife and send an American or an Englishman into Poland to marry his wife, and then they could be reunited a few years from now on the outside. I mean, you know, these heartbreaking really horrible stories. But
do you feel any responsibility to try to follow through on plans that your friends suggest to you?
Yeah, sure. I mean, yeah, it's, I feel a general responsibility to bear witness on Poland, and in particular, to do whatever I can. In fact, there's a movement which I hope will begin to surface fairly soon. I know there is a solidarity support group in New York City that has a list of 4,000 detained people on a computer readout. And what they're trying to do, among other things, is get the occupations and then, in effect, have a kind of adopt-a-prisoner program so that, like, the United Auto Workers should adopt the detainees from the Ursus tractor plant, and the poets, essayists, novelists, Penn should adopt writers, and film directors should adopt film directors, and so forth. And in a somewhat Amnesty International type fashion, just adopting means, you know, just making focusing attention on them and so forth. And that, in a general way, should be done. And sure, until that happens, people who know people really have to be watching out for them.
Well, when you were in Poland talking to a lot of members of Solidarity, what kind of bond did they feel with the American labor movement?
Well, it was the second trip had a particularly interesting situation because the PATCO strike had just happened here in the United States, and Reagan had gutted the air traffic controllers union, and the Polish government was going nuts and saying, "You guys can't strike here. I mean, look, even in the United States, they don't let you strike against the government." And you know, most of the workers in Poland are working for the government, so in effect, and this one man pointed to his badge. We were talking. I was asking him about PATCO, and he said, "You know, PATCO has nothing to do with our arrogance. It has totally to do with the inadequacy of American labor. If American labor had been organized as we're organized, it wouldn't have happened." And he pointed to his badge. He said, "Look at my badge. What does it tell you? It tells you my name, and it tells you my region. From my badges, you can't tell me whether I'm an editor, a coal worker, a shipbuilder, a nurse. You know, all you know is where I come from. We are organized by region. American labor is organized by trade. And it's a lot easier to bust unions when they're organized by trade than by region, because, you know, they had tried to do that with us. And in fact, a few weeks later, they tried to fire a whole group of airline pilots, and the country almost came to a stop over it. Now, a fascinating upshot of all this, which has happened in the meantime, is that the military regime, when it says that it's going to allow something like solidarity to happen, this is a Communist Party military regime, says that in the future, any trade union that develops will be organized by trades, not by regions in Poland. They'll be organized like every other trade union in the world. And then this man, who is the Communist Party spokesman, says, "I mean, what interest do a shoemaker and a shipbuilder possibly have in common? I mean, this is the era of Workers of the World Unite, Karl Marx making that kind of position now." But it gives a sense of how ironic things have gone there.
You quoted, I guess it was a sociologist who said to you that people in Poland are so used to the communist slogans they've started to believe them.
I mean, this is something that was very important. I mean, there was a tendency, I think that's pretty much been washed away in the meantime, but there was an early tendency on the part of a lot of people in the United States to think that what Solidarity was after was a reinstitution of capitalism in Poland. And it definitely was not that. It was a tremendously egalitarian movement. There were all kinds of word games that went on around the word socialism. Thus, for example, the party was going to be allowed to have political functions, but the union would have social functions, is what they would say. And when you'd ask people, what do you mean? What's a political function? They'd say, the kind of thing the party worries about. And you say, what do you mean by a social function? Oh, you know, press, you know, redistribution of income through the society. Everything was basically social. And there was a whole period where people would say, Solidarity represents society. Society wants this. So, I mean, there was a period of 16 months roughly up till the end of, let's say, the first 10 months of it anyway, where you really could say society wants this. And how did you know? Because Solidarity said so. And Solidarity was society. And what Solidarity insisted on was social ownership of the means of production. So, I mean, they really were after socialism as opposed to what they considered to be anti-socialist, which was state ownership, and which is the Communist Party version. But right at the heart of all this was a tremendous egalitarian spirit. And I'll just tell you two stories to bring it out. One of them is that all the wage demands, whenever there were demands for wage increases, were for across the board set amount. So that means, for example, that, and this is, by the way, a demand that was initially made by some of the best paid workers in Poland, the ship workers who were relatively well paid in Gdansk. So that means that if they were negotiating a pay increase, it would be 1,000 zlotys per month for every worker. So that somebody who was working earning 6,000 zlotys a month suddenly had a rather sizable increase. And somebody who was earning 20,000 zlotys a month had, you know, just a small increase. The richers had less, obviously, which, by the way, the exact opposite of the Reagan tax plan, which is a percentage across the board cut so that rich people get huge cuts and poor people get, you know, $5, $10 or something. And that was just taken for granted. I mean, they just had this kind of feeling. Another thing that was one of the most touching things I saw was that when I was there in May, there was at one point a desperate cigarette shortage. Everybody in the country smokes. As somebody said to me, if you'd lived here the last 36 years, you'd smoke too. You know, but basically everybody was running out of cigarettes. And in retrospect, or at the time, people were thinking it was partly government plots to put everybody on edge, you know, just hoarding cigarettes or whatever it was. But in any case, you'd be walking down the street with somebody who was smoking a cigarette and had two cigarettes in his pack and didn't have any more cigarettes. And somebody, a complete stranger, would come up and bum a cigarette off him, and he would give it to him. He would give him his last cigarette in his pack, knowing full well that two blocks down, when he wanted a cigarette, if he saw someone smoking, he could go up to that person. That person wouldn't give it. It was like the society had made a decision, we are not going to have, you know, we're not going to start groveling about cigarettes. We're going to, you know, share this thing until this peters out. As I say in my article, the problem was that nobody could find any matches at that point. I try to be balanced in the book in terms of I try not to be sloganeer about the Communist Party and about because it's very complicated. But it really does seem to me that there are certain positive highlights to what 36 years of communism has done in that country. And one of them is it really has given this kind of egalitarian spirit. Generally speaking, I'd say, by the way, that you know, a lot of us had a tendency to kind of look over there condescendingly and say, gee, isn't this quaint how they're trying to learn democracy here, you know, and so forth and so on. What the workers in Poland were doing for 16 months was, you know, decades ahead of anything the United States has ever tried, you know, and who knows how long before we'll ever get near there. I mean, they were on the edge of some very, very important experiments. And one thing that you have to go in right away is to get rid of the condescension and to go in there in a situation really kind of trying to understand what their problems were, their crises, how they faced them, understand why they failed at the moment they failed and so forth. But
Poland's like become a symbol to many different groups of people in this country. Are you watching that?
Oh, yeah, sure. It's very, very frustrating to watch the kind of symbols come to some people. I mean, the whole "Let Poland be Poland" cabal was rather shocking. I mean, in fact, I was talking with one woman, Jerry Labor, who heads the Helsinki Watch Committee in New York, and her job—I mean, what she does principally—is that she watches out for human rights violations in Eastern Europe and recently, especially in Poland. And she had just gone to the Madrid conference to be an observer at the Madrid conference that was reviewing the Helsinki Accord, whether the Helsinki Accord on human rights was being followed. And obviously, Poland was a big issue. And she said to me that the biggest problem she had as an American trying to argue with Europeans that they should have more vigilance about what's going on in Poland and just people in the world, she said, El Salvador. She said, you know, what they come back at you is saying, you know, it's no use listening to you about anything. You Americans who are concerned about Poland, I mean, our biggest problem in trying to organize around Poland is that the Russians come at us and say, this is just how big powers behave. Look at the United States with El Salvador. And if you want to do anything to help the Poles, you got to confront that kind of behavior in the United States. And I guess it's a long way around of saying that a person whose foreign president and secretary of state whose foreign policy includes what's going on in El Salvador is in no position to champion what the workers in Poland were trying to do.
Let me reintroduce you for our listeners just joining us. Lawrence Wessler is my guest, and he's written a book called Solidarity, Poland in the Season of Its Passion. And it's based on two trips to Poland, one last May and one in September and October. And his reports were initially published in the New Yorker magazine. Let's talk a little bit about the church and the Communist Party in Poland. You say that in the battle between Catholicism and communism for the hearts and minds of the Polish people, only Catholicism was really able to tap in and express Polish nationalism, and you say that that's why the communists haven't really succeeded that well.
It's a absolutely unique situation, and it's a situation that's very confusing to most Americans. I mean, I get a lot of people saying, you know, they're not quite sure what to think of solidarity with all these, you know, papists and papists or however you pronounce it. You know, or is it really some, you know, ecstatic religious group rather than a political group and so forth? I mean, I went in there really not knowing. I mean, for starters, I went in there with the assumption, well, people don't really go to church that much and so forth. And that's not true. They do go to church. I would talk to students at the university, not from the country. I mean, urban, who lived in the, you know, and 80-90% went to church every Sunday. But what you have to understand about it is that what has happened uniquely in Poland and nowhere else in Eastern Europe is that communism, the Communist Party, more so than any other place, was imposed on the Poles after the war. I mean, for example, in East Germany, the Communist Party was an authentic anti-Nazi organization. They had led the leadership, you know, led the resistance. In Czechoslovakia, there was a curious election of some sort, but there was a plurality of people who had, you know, at one point supported something like communism. In Poland, it was imposed as part of Stalin's national security considerations after the war. And in fairness to the Soviet Union, they had just lost 20 million people on their – I mean, that's a figure that Americans should just try to understand. We – you know, I mean, what is that? 100 times? Is it – yeah, 100 times as many people as the Americans lost in World War II were lost by the Soviets and lost on their western border. And, you know, Stalin was not about to have some kind of romantic, potentially anti-Russian – there's age-old hatred between Russians and Poles at predates well before communism was introduced to either place. So he imposed this system on. But Poland was quite Catholic at that point. Nothing like it is today, by the way. One of the things that communism has done for Poland is it's given the Catholic Church a second virginity. It's really quite amazing. But this alternative institution organized almost as a government, I mean, in pastorships and bishoprics and so forth, was there and became completely identified with Polish national traditions and so forth. By the way, another thing you have to understand about Catholicism in Poland is that you've got – historically, you've got this group of people surrounded on the one side by Protestants in Germany and Russian Orthodox in Eastern Orthodoxy on the other side. And these Catholics kind of separated from the rest of – their hearts are kind of in Europe, but they kind of huddle together for out of that. And by the way, also that you have to understand about Poland that for the last 200 years of its history, it's really only been independent as a state, even existed as a state, for 20 years between the two world wars. That the rest of the time it's been this kind of people longing for a state, and they would express that longing through their devotion to the church. I spoke with a perfectly agnostic social scientist who told me that he sent his, you know, 5-year-old son to church every Sunday and so forth. And I said, "Why do you do that?" And he says, "If my son didn't go to church, school, he would never ever understand any Polish poems." And it's become that tied up. Now, the flip side of it is you ask, you know, the same woman at the college, "What do you do about birth control?" And does it have any impact on you? Oh, that's a completely different issue, you know. And of course, she ignores it. And abortion is the principle, you know, very wide open and so forth. And there were, I was walking with this woman and they were having displays on creationism versus Darwinism. And, you know, she said, "Well, you know, it's just stories." And, you know, they're kind of fond of it. They kind of say that, this, you know, the church has to do this because, you know. But what the church has done, this whole underground organization in effect, I mean, or unofficial, it's not underground. I mean, it's fought for its existence in a way, has been to preserve this kind of sense of history, of the alternative history, so that, you know, in church people would learn about what had happened in the strike in 1956 in Poznan, in the Gdansk in 1970 and so forth. And so it's very, very tied up. Part of that also is that solidarity is John Paul's ascension to the papacy and in papacy. Let's see if I can get that word right. Anyway, in 1978 and his subsequent visit in 1979 were tremendously important in kind of, more than anything else, in galvanizing Polish imagination. I mean, one of the things we'll talk about, I suppose, more is that Poles have two streaks running side by side. One of them is this fathomless desolation. They always lose. They always lose. I mean, it's a history of just losing all the time. And the other side by side is this flame of of idealism and, you know, hope that that comes out of that desolation and sometimes bursts forth and then gutters out and so forth. But in a way, I think the flame got lighted more than anything else on this most recent round by John Paul's elevation. They were saying, kind of saying, you know, wait a second, you know, all the Catholics in the world are listening to a Paul. Why do we have to be, you know, we don't always lose. Look, we just won a big one here. And so the pride that they felt in the Pope was just they didn't have to settle for mediocrity, which is what they felt they were settling for. By the way, also within this whole thing is that you got, because there was this situation, the Communist Party was never able to achieve legitimacy. I mean, there's been a question of the legitimacy of the Communist Party in some of the other countries, and it's been tenuous and so forth. And I would say increasingly in Eastern Europe, there's very little left at all. But in Poland, they never achieved any kind of legitimacy. So in fact, they became more and more insular and more corrupt just because there was no organic connection to the working class in Poland and because the working class was devoted to the Catholic Church.
I know you were interested also in the subject of anti-Semitism in Poland. You pointed out there were like 30% of the population before World War II.
30% of the population of Warsaw. 10% of the population of the country.
Right.
30% of the urban population. Yeah.
Was Jewish before the war, and now it's 2%, is it?
Oh, much less. It's very complicated, actually. It's a very... One of the things that Poles will tell you, without a moment's circumspection, without a moment's irony, is that one of the principal things that made solidarity possible was that the country is 99% ethnically pure. And that, they say that just purely descriptively. They say, you know, no other country is as pure. Like in Spain, there's all these different types of Spaniards, and, you know, but we are pure. And it's like it's said to you without any bad conscience about what has been involved in becoming that way. Because in 1939, as we said, 30% of the population of Warsaw was Jewish, 10% of the population of the whole. During the war, the vast majority of the Polish Jewish population was wiped out by the Nazis. There is considerable evidence that the Poles were less than heroic in their attempts to save the Jews. It's an understatement. There are many Polish Jews here who will tell you that, you know, that the Poles were perfectly happy to see the Jewish population wiped out. There is considerable... This is the most complicated section of my book and in fact was the section that got almost all the letters when it appeared in The New Yorker, because I more or less go in with what is the American Jewish Party line, which is, you know, that Poland is tremendously anti-Semitic, and in fact today there are only 5,000 old